distracting or really boring. I apologise if it's the latter. Okay, well, as we've heard quite a bit of today, parametallurgy process design has got a lot of challenges when it comes to doing any kind of modelling. I'm particularly interested in computational modelling, but modelling in general, you've got a huge number of phenomena that are going on: heat transfer, fluid dynamics, electromagnetics, phase change, multi-phase flow, free surface flow, granular flow, thermochemistry. I'm sure there are more that I've forgotten. But they're often all going on at the same time. So if we actually want a holistic model of our process, we've got to do a lot of coupled modeling, which is quite difficult. We're looking at using high-performance computing at Mintec in a number of different fields at the moment, including molecular modeling, so material science modeling to try and understand the behavior of slags and metals in the molten state. We're also looking at discrete element modeling that Hank was talking about a bit earlier. We're actually looking at it as an application in simple dark furnace burn beds. We've done quite a lot of work previously on thermal radiation modeling, looking at how radiation moves energy around free water furnaces. And what I'm going to be talking about a little bit more today is the CFD magnetohydrodynamic type of modeling, which we use to study plasma arcs. So why are we interested in studying arcs? Well, plasma arcs are really a key heating and stirring element in all kinds of arc furnaces. At Mintec, we've got a particular interest in DC arc furnaces, but obviously this is of relevance to open arc AC as well. Modeling is a nice way to study this problem because it's a very, very harsh environment to study experimentally. You've got heat to electromagnetic radiation and interference, dust. It's just dirty and messy. It's very, very difficult to do any kind of measurement at all. And it's an interesting problem. You've got very high fluid velocities and very large electromagnetic forces that are going on inside the arc, and these things result in extremely rapid motion and evolution of the arc into very complex shapes and structures. Anybody who tells you an arc is axisymmetric and steady state really needs to see some photos like this. So how do we go about modeling arcs? Well, that's a coupled problem. We've got the equations governing fluid flow, Navier-Stokes equations. We've got the energy transfer equations governing temperature fields. And we've got electromagnetic equations, Maxwell's equations for magnetostatics and electrostatics, which all work together and couple into each other to actually give you the structure of the arc. The arc is a multi-physics phenomenon. It's inherently multi-physics. Once we've got all those equations written down, we've got to solve them somehow. So we've written our own codes in-house to do that, mainly because we're very interested in looking at the time behavior of the arc. So we need very high performance codes, very specialized stuff. So we're using a run cutter type discretization for our time solution, which has got some very nice stability properties. And we're using very, very simple two-dimensional, three-dimensional finite difference methods on Cartesian grids, which give us the advantage of being very, very simple and being easy to parallelize, because what we want to do is we want to scale these models up to very, very, very large resolutions, temporally and spatially, so that we can actually get fully resolved flow. So we're basically resolving everything that we can in the physics in the numerical model. The kinds of things that we can model with arcs, with the arc models, well, we're limited to pretty small scale at the moment. This is sort of lab and pilot plant size stuff. But given that limitation, we can look at quite a lot of different effects. We can look at how arcs start up and how they form. We can look at how the dynamics of arcs change with different process parameters. We can look at multiple arcs and how they interact together in a tight space. We can look at reverse polarity arcs, what happens when we change the direction of current flow through the arc. We can look at brush arcs when we make the arc very short. We can change the composition of the gas environment, all of these things. I've just got a couple of quick examples here that I'm going to go through. This is some studies that we've done looking at the formation of arcs. So here we've got an arc in air. It's 500 amps. It's 5 centimeters in length, so it's a really little thing. We start out with a uniform temperature field at 1,000 Kelvin and zero initial velocity. And we see what happens as all the coupled physics starts to come into play. And right early on in the beginning part of the development of the arc, we get a nice hot arc jet forming directed away from the cathode at the top. formation of anode arcs, spontaneous arcs forming on the surface of the anode at the bottom, as you can see there. And again, this is something that we see in high-speed imaging. It's a real phenomenon. Then moving on to the effect of something like current, which is... here what we've got is two arcs. On the left is 100 amps, on the right is 250 amps. We're just looking at a plot of the velocity magnitude. And what you see is that the low current arcs tend to form very unstable jets. As we go up in current slightly, we get a regular oscillation and precession of the arc jet around the attachment spot. We then go to even higher currents here. We've got, again, two arcs, but both of them at 500 amps each. We get another transition in the dynamics to very, very chaotic type behavior. And that's just showing you what's happening here. We're looking at the plot of arc voltages in those models, bearing out the fact that you get these distinct levels of transition in the nature of the behavior over very, very short time scales. It's worth noting as well. This has a bearing on particularly DC voltages when you have very high frequency rectification. Potentially, you can get some interaction between the arc's behavior and the rectifier as well. So, well, this is all very nice. We can model these nice fully resolved models of little arcs at maybe 500 amps, maybe 5 centimeters in length. We still need an awful lot of computer power to do this. 40 to 50 gigaflops. Flop is a floating point operation per second, if anybody doesn't know. That sounds like a fair bit, but it's probably equivalent to a high-end workstation today. So you can do it on a desktop, but you need a pretty good computer to do it. But what we'd really like to do is take these same models, these fully resolved direct numerical simulation type models, and run them on industrial scale arcs. And there's a reason why that's important, it's because it lets us do something called virtual prototyping. Now this is I'm digressing wildly here, this is going to do with paramentology, but I just thought it's a nice case study to have a look at how this sort of thing can change industries. This is an example from the automotive industry vehicle impact safety testing. Basically, the old way of doing it was, if you wanted to design a new model of a car, you built a prototype of it, you crashed it into a wall, measured some data from your crash, and you modified a new prototype, you crashed that into a wall, and you carried on and on and on until you finally got to the point where you were pretty happy that if you crashed your car into a wall, it wasn't going to kill the people inside. Now, it's expensive and it takes quite a long time. So up until about the early 80s, this was the way that everybody lived. Around the early 80s, suddenly you had the advent of finite element analysis, and computational stress and deformation analysis became possible for individual monolithic vehicle components. So you could take a door and put a force on it and measure the deformation and stresses involved. That sort of thing. It was very crude, it was really inaccurate, but it was interesting to the industry. But it didn't really change anything in terms of how cars were developed in terms of their safety. You still had the same product development pipeline, but now you're just complementing it by saying, at the end, I can have a look at comparing against my models and see whether our models are working. Usually they worked. Around about 1986 or so, suddenly, you got enough computer power and enough sophistication in the FEA models that you could accurately simulate an entire multi-component vehicle and its impact with a solid body. So at this point, suddenly you're able to do something called virtual prototyping, which is building a prototype inside the computer, doing all your test and development inside the computer. And once you've got a refined prototype, you can then, at the end of that process, build the real one and crash test it just to make sure that your models were right. And these days they're all well. So it lets you do more tests. It lets you get better quality in less time, less power, which is obviously very appealing. And around about this time is where the sort of time between models for the car industry went from 7 to 8 years to 3 to 4 years. So it enabled them to shrink the product development pipeline by maybe a factor of half or two. So we really like to do virtual prototyping for our scale up to industrial scale. Very, very crudely. This is pretty hand-waving stuff, but it gives us an idea of the kind of problem we're looking at here. You increase your Reynolds number of your flow by a factor of about 1,000. In 3D, because you're doing a fully resolved flow simulation, you have to scale your grid density as the 3/4 power of the Reynolds number, so you need to increase mesh size by 180 times in each direction. And you actually need to scale up the overall computer power needed for the simulation by a factor of about 5.6 million to 225 petaflops, which is 10 to the 15 floating point operations per second. Now, the most powerful computer in the world at the moment is around 10 petaflops, so we still have a good way to go. But let's do a little bit of a prediction exercise and see how long it will take us to get there. This is just some data off the top 500 list of the most powerful computers in the world. It's put out once every 6 months, and it has been going since about 1993. The top set of data is the fastest machine on the list, so position one, and the bottom set of data is the slowest machine on the list, which is actually a bit more interesting to me for a reason I'll get to in a second. But what you can see here is that it's scaling very, very, very exponentially with time. I mean, if I fit exponential curves on this, the data fits extremely well. So that encourages us to do a few predictions. And it's worth noting that even though these are very, very powerful machines, it still has South African relevance. We have some machines down in Cape Town that are on this list, certainly in the last 3 or 4 years. We can do the same sort of exercise looking at desktop computer power as well. Again, the bottom set of data here is looking at CPUs, so traditional central processing units. The top set of data is a new kind of technology called GPGPU, which is General Purpose Graphics Processing Unit. It's a highly parallel stream processor type of co-processor. It's a commodity item you can buy and put it in your desktop today. And we can do the same exercise of fitting exponential growth curves to those, and again, over quite a large period of time, that fit works pretty well. So, what we're really seeing is the sustained exponential growth in available compute power in pretty much all areas of compute. This is the classic sort of Moore's Law thing that we always see and hear about, and more people kind of can't say it's dead, the more it seems to just carry on and on and on. The high-performance computing end of things is growing faster than desktop end of things, but you do get these disruptive technologies like GPGPU that come along and can give you an order of magnitude or two increase for desktop type applications. The trends in high performance computing are very worth taking note of because they're towards massive parallelism, so hundreds of thousands of processors in these big machines, and processor communications and heterogeneity. In other words, they're using a lot of different infrastructures to connect the processors together. Processors themselves are not necessarily all the same, they can be different. And all of these kinds of trends are things we need to be cognizant of because they will be coming down onto desktops sooner rather than later. They're quite important, particularly in the context of modeling, because it's often quite difficult to program a piece of code to take advantage of this kind of parallelism. To get back to our original question though, when are we really going to get all this power to play with? Well, okay, let's do some predictions. This is using the same curves that we fitted, just projecting a few decades into the future. The top band is the top 500 list from fastest to slowest, and the bottom band is basically the area that's covered by GPU and CPU technology on the desktop. So just drawing some lines on there, 40 gigaflops is what we need now today to do our models, and you can see we're pretty much well into the range of being able to do that on the desktop comfortably. 225 petaflops, well, that's quite a bit further up, but it's not as far away as you think. The fastest machine in the world will do that in only 5 years. The slowest machine on the top 500 list will do that in 2024, 7 years after that. And that's relevant because that means at that point, if the CHPC continues their development path in South Africa, we will have a local machine available to South African researchers of that class. Johan Zittman spoke a little bit earlier about the kind of things that you need to come together in order for modeling to be adopted in industry. I think the three things that I really focus on are hardware. You've got to have a fast and accessible computer. So not only must it be very fast, you must be able to get to it. You need good software and tools, and it needs to be not only able to do the problems that you want to do, but must be accurate enough to satisfy somebody that is doing an engineering kind of problem. And finally, of course, you need expertise in human capital. You need clever people to actually take the good software and tools and use them on fast computers, otherwise they're just not going to be used for anything. And I think those last two things are really where this initiative with the University of Pretoria, with the Power of Intelligence Chair and Model, can really, really help. The hardware is coming. That's an unstoppable avalanche. There's nothing we can do about that. What we've got to do is make sure that we can develop tools for our field and people to use those tools to take advantage of the hardware that's coming down the line. And you're not alone in this. I think it's important to realize that you've got a lot of high-performance computing resources in South Africa that you can take advantage of, particularly as a university or research institute. We've got the Centre for High-Performance Computing down in Cape Town, which can provide you with nice fast computers. We've got the South African National Research Network, SANREN, which gives you a nice fast backbone around the country to connect and move your data around. We've got SA Group, which is the